Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a really exciting founder, you know, a founder that was born in Startup Nation, but we're going to be talking about building and scaling here. You know, there's a really exciting podcast, you know, episode that we have in front of us. We're going to be talking about how they actually turned their business, their venture business, you know, pretty much, you know, into profitability, how they think about people and then also retention, as well as doing the hard work, you know, and some of the stuff that they learn from outsourcing, some of the things that they were doing. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Ron Reske. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Very excited.
So originally born in Israel, but you moved quite a little bit, you know, growing up. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up?
Yeah, life for me was very interesting. So as you mentioned, I was born in Israel, but I actually grew up in Kenya in Africa. We moved there when I was 4 years old, and I went to the same school all the way from kindergarten to 12th grade. I went to the International School of Kenya, which was an American-based school, and that to me was normal growing up in Kenya, because people keep asking me, what was it like growing up in Kenya? I said, I don't know. I never grew up anywhere else, so I didn't know what to compare it to. But yeah, I was there all through school, and then I went to college in Pennsylvania, which was a small difference.
A small difference, but I mean, talking about difference too, mechanical engineering, which you never used. Why mechanical engineering out of all things?
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, when I was graduated when I was 17 and a half years old, I didn't know what I wanted to be in life. My dad, he had a degree in mechanical engineering. He worked as a civil engineer. He actually never worked as a mechanical engineer, but I thought, you know what? I like math. I like physics. That's something I should probably do. I didn't know what I wanted to do. But the interesting thing about engineering is that it actually, because midway through the degree, I was like, yeah, I think I'm going to stop this. I'm going to change to a different degree. And I remember my parents saying, no. You're going to finish. You're going to get your engineering degree and then figure out what you want to do in life. But the interesting thing about mechanical engineering, or any engineering in general, is that it teaches you how to problem solve. Hey, there's a problem. How do we go about and solve it? And so at the time, I didn't enjoy it, but I'm happy I got to finish my degree in engineering.
So investment banking, you know, sounds like it was, you know, the way to go for you. And I guess, you know, from investment banking too, and seeing, you know, all these companies that were doing well, companies that were doing not so well, were there any patterns or any exciting things that you saw about the world of business?
Yeah, I mean, I again, anybody who's looking to get into the world of business, I strongly recommend, if you can, do a few years of investment banking. You may not enjoy it so much the first few years as an analyst, where you're staying up till 3 and 4 a.m. creating books. Sometimes people actually never look at those books. I only found that years later when I actually met with the investment banks. It's funny, whenever I meet with investment banks right now, I make sure we go through the entire deck and I tell them, please thank the analyst who is working on this, because I used to be that analyst who was up till 4 a.m. working on those books. But investment banking is very interesting because it actually teaches you how to understand businesses, whether it's reading it through financial statements or understanding their strategy. And so I thought it was a great segue into the business world. To be honest, I felt like I always wanted to start my own business, and I always had ants in my pants saying like, okay, I want to go do something. And it was always like, okay, is it going to be now? Maybe I'll learn a little bit more. Maybe I'll learn a little bit more. But in hindsight, I'm happy I did those few years in investment banking.
And obviously, you know, this was right around the time where you kind of like wanted to get a little bit of a taste of doing something, you know, something of your own. So what was that idea, and how, obviously it didn't unfold the way that you had hoped for, but I'm sure as the saying goes, you either succeed or you learn.
Yeah. So I started a company in 2007 called Groupster, and that was Group Discounts. This is before Groupon had taken off. And I met with a bunch of VCs because obviously I had to raise money for it. And they told me that this has got this, they're like, you seem like a smart guy, but this has to be the dumbest idea I've ever heard. This isn't good. This isn't scalable. What are you going to go business to business? And why doesn't, I heard, why doesn't Google do it? Why doesn't eBay do it? There was no Amazon at the time. It wasn't as big as it was, but I'm sure if it was, they would tell me that Amazon is going to go do it. And there's no technology advantage here. And I was like, yeah, absolutely. There's no technology. There's execution. I think I can out-execute. But long story short, I used all my investment banking bonuses to bootstrap the business, but unfortunately, it never really took off. But again, that was a good, I view that as a good learning lesson of how to think about business, how to think about unit economics. So unit economics were actually broken at the time. And so in hindsight, I was like, oh man, that was poor execution. Unit economics didn't work. Of course, the business wasn't going to work.
I mean, it didn't work, but you definitely wanted to keep going on the venture side of things. You know, you even joined their venture capital firm. So how was that transition into VC?
Yeah, so I joined Norris Venture Partners. I was very fortunate to join Norris Venture Partners as they were opening up an office in Israel. They were making a lot of investments in Israel, and then they decided that, hey, it's time for us to actually have feet on the ground in Israel. Now, in Israel, at the time, it was Startup Nation, a lot of ideas, mostly technology, high technology businesses. They weren't really focused on scaling businesses. It was mostly, hey, let's try to sell the technology. We were mostly looking at investing in B2B businesses, businesses with strong technology, strong IP. And I was more interested in consumer. And at the time, Israel did not have a strong presence in consumer deals. And so the team, after I was there for quite a while, from 2009 to 2012, they said, hey, if you're interested in consumer, why don't you move to the US and join our consumer focus team? They have a team just focused on consumer deals. And I told my wife, what do you think? She said, good news. The bags are already packed. We can go as soon as we're ready. And so end of 2012, we moved to Palo Alto. And I joined the group that just focused on consumer deals. And for me, that was a good learning to really understand, hey, how are these businesses thinking about customer acquisition? How are they thinking about unit economics? How are they scaling? And it's pretty interesting. I mean, you know, 2013, 14, 15, those were the days of scale as much as you can. And who cares about the unit economics? And I always thought to myself, I was like, okay, great. We're going to keep scaling. But what happens if we run out of money? Or what happens if new investors don't want to invest? Then what happens? And so that was always like an aha moment for me that, hey, these unit economics are not actually working. And that's something that when I start my business, that's something that I'm going to do. Now, it is important to mention that I've always had this startup bug in me where I've always said, hey, I want to do something of my own. And I think for the other entrepreneurs that are out there, this is obviously a positive and a negative. Because you're never, as an entrepreneur, you're never satisfied with not doing something of your own. And at the same time, the negative part of all this is it's hard.
Now, being there with Norwest, I mean, you were there for close to 7 years. What were the three biggest things that you got about the ingredients of why companies would be incredibly successful or perhaps the ones that would fail?
So I'll give you the biggest one. And to me, it's around the entrepreneurs themselves, the ones that are dreamers. And, you know, as entrepreneurs, it's always, is a glass half full or half empty? The ones that are successful, that's not even a question. The glass is not only half full, it's overflowing. And you, Mr. Investor, who doesn't realize that, you're the one who can't see. But for me as the entrepreneur, the glass is so overflowing, of course it's going to be successful. And the entrepreneurs that I thought were the I mean, were able to get their businesses to be big successes were the ones that, hey, it didn't matter what happened. Environment was up, environment was down, roadblocks, they would go around them, through them, whatever it is, they were just able to be successful. The other thing is, I realized around product market fit, sometimes people have an idea and it may be that timing is too early and you're essentially just running an uphill battle. We'll talk about Resident in a second, but for us, when we started selling the mattresses, we essentially hit product market fit day one. It was just people were buying it and there was demand in the market and everything was working well. And so we didn't feel like we were running an uphill battle trying to force something on somebody. It was already there. And again, I tell people, hey, my opinion is try to find product market fit that already exists instead of trying to create something that you think people need, but they don't think that they need.
Yeah, no, I hear you on that. Now, what was that moment where you realize, I think it's my time to take a step at it again?
You know, you're always looking for the right partners. And for me, it was at a Norwest sponsored event. And I met my current, I'd known Eric, for a while, but it was at that event when I was like, hey, Eric, how you doing? What's new? And he was like, oh yeah, I'm leaving, my current company right now. And I was like, well, what are you going to do? And he goes, well, I don't know. And I was like, hey, let's do something together. Now is the time. And so again, I think to be successful, there's a lot of luck that needs to happen. And for me, the luck was finding, a partner like Eric, in that we just get along so, so well. And, you know, the timing kind of worked out that, I was looking for an opportunity and, that opportunity kind of came in that he was just leaving his job.
So what happened next?
So we talk about, okay, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? Okay, we say we agree. We're going to start a business together. What is it that we're going to do? So what space do we like? So we both like the commerce space. Why? Because people are always going to buy. Okay, so we like the commerce space, e-commerce specifically. It's kind of growing. What categories? And so we really kind of turn this into a consulting project as opposed to, I know some people start businesses based off of their passion. For us, this is like, hey, what's out there? What should we be doing? So we were looking at, a few different categories, but one of the things specifically that we looked at was we wanted, the business to be profitable on first purchase. And so the unit economics had to make sense. For the business to be profitable on first purchase. And so that means that you have to have a high average order value because your customer acquisition has to be high enough on that first purchase. And so we were looking at a few different categories and then we kind of landed on the mattress category. The truth is that first I kind of like the pillow space, because I don't know how familiar you are with the MyPillow guy. And I was like, I've seen his products. That's all marketing. And I was like, I think we could beat that guy. And so I reached out to this gentleman who was importing, pillows and mattresses at the time from China. You can't import mattresses from China anymore, but at the time, he was doing it. And I reached out to him and I said, hey, we're interested in the pillows. And he goes, why are you interested in the pillows? I have such a great mattress for you and the unit economics make more sense. And essentially he convinced me. So I told Eric, hey, so I think we're going to be selling mattresses. And that's essentially kind of how we landed on the mattresses. Everything about it made sense. It was a growing category. There were a lot of players in the space at the time. I think when we started there, people said that there's something like 100, D2C players in the mattress category. And we said, that's great. That means that there's product market fit. People want it. And so now it's up to execution, and we feel comfortable competing around execution.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So for the people listening to get it, what ended up being the business model of Resident? How do you guys make money there?
So Resident, we are a direct-to-consumer mattress and bedding related holding company. We have a number of brands. Our largest is Nectar and Dream Cloud, and then we have other brands addressing different niches in the market. We have Awar, which is in the organic space. We have Sienna, which is slightly in the low end. We recently launched a luxury mattress called Clover Lane, and essentially we're selling to the mass market, slightly less than premium prices, but mass market, mastige, call it, products.
So for this, you guys have raised quite a bit of money too. How much money have you guys raised to date?
So we don't really share the amount of money that we raised, but I could talk a little bit about our funding rounds. We initially bootstrapped the business. And the interesting thing that we did around our business was negative working capital. And for those who don't know what negative working capital means, is that essentially you get somebody else to finance your growth. And so we were able to find, when you start spending enough with Google and Facebook, they'll give you terms. They'll give you 30-day terms. So you're spending marketing dollars today. The customers are paying you today, and then you're paying Google and Facebook in 30 days. So you get terms from there. Then we're able to get terms from our suppliers. And they said, okay, we'll send. So we, in the beginning, when we started the business, we actually did not hold any inventory. All our suppliers held our inventory and they drop ship from us. And then they would give us terms as well. In the beginning, it was like maybe 10 days, 15 days, but still, as you're scaling the business, you're doing well. Problem with negative working capital is that if you're scaling, everything works well. The problem is if you're not scaling and you're not profitable, that's where you have problems. So we launched a business end of 2016. In 2018, we did our first funding round. And that was from friends and families and some more friends of theirs and some of their family members. And it was a big, it was a $10.5 million round. But it was with a lot of different investors, anywhere from millions of dollars, family offices to, friends writing checks for tens of thousands of dollars, $25,000,
$50,000. That's amazing. I was just going to say there too that, I mean, obviously I know that you are not not sharing this. You know, obviously it's been reported by Crunchbase. I think it's like about 169 million, but again, I don't want you to confirm or anything. That's at least what is out there. But the question here is, as part of the business, I mean, when you go into the venture, you know, mode like this, like you were going, you know, you're always going to go and push for growth. I think that things have changed quite a bit in that regard. You know, nowadays with the macro environment, you know, where it's more like profitability versus growth. And before, you know, it was like growth above everything else. Now, one thing that is very interesting is that you guys anticipated that early in 2019. And I don't know what triggered that, but you ended up pushing for profitability at that point, you know, against the current, which was growth above everything else at that point. So what pushed, you know, for that to happen? And then also, how was that transition into really making sure that you were able to get the company profitable?
Yeah, so you bring up an excellent point in that, you know, for the venture community, it was always about growth and don't worry, we'll figure out profitability later. But when you stop for a second, you say, okay, what if we're not a venture company? What if we were the store, the corner store, right? So think about this: would anybody ever invest in the corner store if it was losing money? No chance whatsoever. And so for us, it was kind of like this mindset: wait a second, we're a store. Just because we're selling online doesn't change the fact that we're a retailer. And so for us to exist, we have to be profitable. A business cannot exist if it's not profitable, or call it a retailer cannot exist if it's not. And that was kind of the switch in our head. And so we said, hey, no matter what happens, we have to figure our unit economics out and make sure that we are profitable no matter what. And so when you think about unit economics, I mean, the way we think about it is around contribution margin. So you have your gross sales, and then underneath that, you have your returns, cancellations, maybe payment processing fees, and that gives you your net sales. And then you have your COGS, including the product costs themselves, the shipping, the fulfillment, all of that, all of those costs as well. And then you have your marketing. All those costs together, you have to be making money. Because otherwise, why are you even selling one unit if after all these things, you're not making any money? And so for us, it was, hey, no matter what happens, this is something that we needed to do. And so we're very, very sophisticated in our marketing. I mean, in our data analytics, making sure that we understand attribution as much as you can. I mean, attribution is kind of a black hole. You're never fully going to understand exactly where the user came from. But we know we built a pretty sophisticated platform to understand, hey, money that we're going to spend today, because mattress is a considered purchase. It takes time for the customer to actually make the purchase, but we understand money that we spent today, when are we going to realize it? And we feel confident in that spend. And so once we figured out our unit economics, it was around, okay, let's make sure that our operating expenses are where they need to be to make sure that we are profitable. And so in 2019, as you mentioned, when we decided, hey, no matter what happens, we're going to be profitable, we had to cut our operating expenses. And unfortunately, as part of that, that meant that we did a RIF, a reduction in force. And again, if I were to go back in time, I would have done it differently, because all those entrepreneurs and executives who've had to do a reduction in force, it's always around, well, I can't cut anymore, because if I have to cut more, then it's really going to affect my business. And so the mistake that we made was, unfortunately, we did it three times, because the first time wasn't deep enough, second time wasn't deep enough, the third time wasn't deep enough. But the third time we kind of got to where we needed to go. And then when you think about employee morale, it's not pleasant for those that are staying, obviously, it's not pleasant to go through that three times, be like, oh, am I next? Am I going to be the next one to be cut? And so if we go back in time, we would have been like, okay, how deep can we go? And then you go a little bit deeper, And that's probably where you should go. But I mean, having spoken to different executives, it's always like, well, I can't cut these people because if I do, my whole business is going to go under. I would challenge those executives to be like, really, really dig deep and see, hey, if you need to make cuts, how deep can you go?
Now, one thing that you guys say have been able to really manage well is employee retention. And I guess that, you know, all of that, you know, getting also the investors on board, I mean, it all rallies around vision, right? Like the future that you're living into. So in that regard, if you were to go to sleep tonight, Ran, and you wake up in a world where the vision of Resident is fully realized, how does that world look like?
So you mentioned two things, right? One, employees and vision, right? I mean, as founders, as executives, essentially you are, you've been granted the ability to affect somebody's life, your employees for that matter. And they are trusting you to all the things that you told them when you're trying to convince them to join your company, you want to realize it for them. So the first things first is that they should be enjoying every day. I mean, I talk to our employees all the time and I say, hey, if you don't feel like you're fulfilled, if you don't feel like you're happy, if being here is not what you imagined it to be, then life is short, right? You should go find somewhere else, because that's the most important thing, is for you to be fulfilled and say, and we're very fortunate in that nobody really leaves the company. We had only one senior exec leave out of his own will, but everybody else has really stayed with the company. Or unfortunately, we've had to let some people go along the way, but it wasn't their decision; it was our decision. So in terms of the vision, is to continue to be a place where people feel fulfilled. People feel like, hey, they're really, really able to get what they wanted out of their career. In terms of the business, where would I like to get business is, you know, I'm a competitive. Our team is full of competitors. We want to be number one. We want to be number one in our mattress category. We want to be number one in the entire home goods category. That's much, call it longer vision, but I mean, that's kind of where we see the business going. We want everybody in the country to be sleeping on our products. We want everybody to be using our, going to other categories in the home, and really being that that number one player. And again, it's you know, it's ambitious goals, but if we don't have ambitious goals, then what are we doing here?
That's right. That's right. So obviously now we're talking about the future, but I want to talk about the past with a lens of reflection. So let's say I put you into a time machine, Ran, and I bring you back in time, maybe to that moment that you're right there, you know, at the VC firm at Norwest Venture Partners, and you are thinking about maybe it's time to do something of your own, and you're able to sit right there in front of your younger self and give that younger self one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
So there's never the right time. And this is because it's always, I was always like, you know, I have three kids now. At the time when I launched, I had two kids. It was always, hey, should I take this risk? But what if it doesn't work out? Is now the right time? And so I remember I spoke with my dad about this, and he goes, if you're looking for an excuse not to start the business, I can probably give you 2,000 excuses not to start the business. At the end of the day, there's never the right time. The markets are always going to be up. They're always going to be down. You can wait a few more years. But if you really want to start a business, now is the right time. Today, right now. Because starting a business, you have to actually start it. And the best way to learn about how to grow a business is to do it. Do it yourself. I mean, you can read as many books as you like. You can talk to mentors. And I advise different startups. But I'm not living it. The entrepreneurs are living it. And they're going to be making the mistakes. And that's the only real way to learn, in my opinion, is to actually do. And so if I were to go back in time, I would have done it sooner.
That's amazing. So for the people that are listening, Ran, you know, I would love to reach out and say hi. What is the best way for them to do so?
LinkedIn. LinkedIn is definitely the best way. Yeah, my LinkedIn, just look me up on LinkedIn, Ran Reske, R-A-N-R-E-S-K-E. And I'm responsive on LinkedIn. And you know what? I actually made a lot of good connections on LinkedIn. And we found our first manufacturing partner on LinkedIn, believe it or not. And we found some great employees through LinkedIn. And actually, we found our current CFO on LinkedIn. And so I think LinkedIn is a fantastic platform and a fantastic resource. And guess what? A lot of people haven't responded to my messages on LinkedIn as well. But I think you have to put yourself out there and try. And who knows? You might get a good response from somebody, and it might change your business.
Absolutely. Well, easy enough for all the people that are listening. Well, Ran, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an honor to have you with us.
Thank you so much. This is fun.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.